is John Gibson. This is the Saturday morning author interview for what am I going to do? Post this on March 14th. So this is the March 14th author interview. The author is Don Bentley. This is his first published book. He's written a thriller called Without Sanction, a Matt Drake thriller. It's just out a week or so ago. It's very good. I've been reading it, and I've found it very exciting and aptly described as a thriller. And Don Bentley has some experience in this area, so we're gonna talk to Don Bentley now. Joining me now is Don Bentley, the author of Without Sanction, a Matt Drake thriller. Congratulations, Don, on the book. This is your first published one?
It is. It's my first published one. Wrote three that didn't sell and took 17 years to get here. So I'm kind of the overnight sensation that takes 17 years to get published. So, yes.
I see. Now, just by way of introduction, before those 17 years, you spent 10 years flying Apache helicopters?
I did, yeah. It's I went to college on an Army ROTC scholarship, and then after school, I spent 10 years on active duty in the Army flying Apache gunships, and it is hard to have a bad day when you're flying Apache helicopters.
Well, I can think of one kind of thing that would make for a bad day. I guess that never happened to you. And you also worked as an FBI special agent, and you were a member of SWAT teams?
That's right. Yeah, I was for a couple of years, I was an FBI special agent in the Dallas field office and a member of their SWAT team.
I see. Okay, so you've got a ton of expertise in this stuff. So I don't, you know, the book, once again, is called Without Sanction. And it is a Matt Drake thriller, the hero's Matt Drake. Now, I kind of leave it to the author to, you know, tell as much or as little about the story and the plot as he likes, because we don't want to be a spoiler, or I don't want to be a spoiler. You're welcome to spoil
sure.
On. So what is it that happens here? I know it's set in Syria. You know, there's some interfacing with Russians. And so why don't you tell me what you can?
Sure. So, I mean, at its core, Without Sanction is a book about redemption, and in particular, a character, Matt Drake, who is my protagonist, who is offered a chance at redemption if he is brave enough to take it. And the way, I guess, to kind of explain that, if you want, I can go a little bit into how my background kind of informed the book and maybe talk a little bit about why, what the book is and why the book is what it is.
Yeah, sure.
If that makes sense.
Yeah,
okay.
Sure.
So one of my very good friends is a writer named Nick Petrie, and he's a fiction writer, and he has a number of fantastic books. The first one is called The Drifter. And he told me that in a really good book, what's happening is the novelist is trying to work out a question for themselves in the pages of the book. And so the first part of Without Sanction came from my time as an Apache pilot in the Army, and in particular, a combat tour I did in Afghanistan from 2005 to 2006. And so there was one mission in particular during my tour in Afghanistan where I was the air mission commander for a series of Apaches that were responding to a number of SEALs that we'd lost contact with. And the mission went tragically wrong, and there wasn't anything I could do to stop it. And so when you see that happen, when you see that happen in front of you, you have several questions, or maybe a progression of questions that you deal with after it's over. And kind of the first of those questions is what could I have done differently? And how can I get that minute in time back, or that couple moments in time back to make a different decision? And you know that you can't get that moment back, in your head at least, but your heart doesn't know that. And you spend a lot of time thinking about that. And then from there, you kind of progress to what what am I ever going to do in my life that is going to have that much relevance again, or that much significance, that, you know, maybe that was the moment in time you feel like you spent your entire career getting ready for, and then it goes sideways and you can't do anything about it. And that probably leads to the third and final question, which is, what can I do to kind of atone for that moment in time, or make up for the fact perhaps that I'm still here and other people aren't? And so those were the questions I was really wrestling with as I was writing Without Sanction. And so my protagonist is a guy named Matt Drake, who is a case officer for the Defense Intelligence Agency. And what case officers do is run and recruit what we in the FBI call sources, or what folks in the intelligence community call assets. And those are basically people who have answers to the questions that you're looking to answer. And those, you know, if you're in the FBI and it's a criminal organization, maybe those questions are where the money's coming from, who's laundering the money, or who's stealing the drugs, or something like that. And if you're working in the intelligence community, those questions tend to focus more on national importance. Things like, perhaps, you know, is there a scientist in this particular WMD program that I can get to work for me and provide me information? And when the book starts, Matt had an asset in Syria that he was running who was killed. And in fact, the asset and the asset's family were both killed. And Matt feels like he's responsible for that asset's death. And so he is, like I said, when the book starts, he's in kind of a self-imposed exile from the Defense Intelligence Agency. And because he feels like his failure has permanently changed the lives of everyone around him, and he's dealing with quite a bit of survivor's guilt. And what happens is there's another asset that kind of surfaces and reaches out to Matt and says, hey, I am currently embedded with an ISIS splinter cell in Syria, and I've developed this novel chemical weapon, which none of our current equipment can detect. And I'm willing to give that to you, Matt Drake, but you have to be the one to come to Syria and bring me out. And so that sets up kind of the crux of the book, of that question of, can you really atone for something? And if you could, are you brave enough to, in Matt's case, go back to Syria where everything went wrong and kind of give it another try? And so that's kind of the first half of what brought my book together, or first third, if you will. The second third is my experience as an FBI agent. And like I said, when I was an FBI agent, my job was to run and recruit, again, what we call sources. And it's a fascinating job, in that what you're doing is convincing somebody to work for you and to provide information for you. And sometimes when they provide that information for you, it can put them into harm's way. Now, if you think of a criminal organization and you get somebody inside that organization to provide information to you, if the other members of that organization find out about it, it could certainly put that person in harm's way. And so there's this very interesting dynamic that develops there, where your job is to run that person and find answers to questions. But as a human being, you develop a relationship with them as well. And so there can be tension in that relationship. And so I wanted to bring that tension into the book as well, and perhaps have my protagonist do a job that not a whole lot of protagonists in this genre do. And so that's why Matt's a case officer for the Defense Intelligence Agency. And then kind of the last part of that in my background actually happened after I got out of the FBI, and then I went to work for a small company that marketed and developed technology for Special Operations Command. And the majority of my coworkers all hailed from the special operations community. And four of the folks I worked with quite closely all came from the Army's very vaunted 75th Ranger Regiment. And so that Ranger Regiment has what's called a Ranger Creed. And to you or I, it might look just like another mission statement that Human Resources comes up with. But for folks who were or are Rangers, that Ranger Creed, those six stanzas, govern their lives both as a Ranger and once they leave the Ranger Regiment. And I got to see that firsthand through my coworkers' eyes, and I wanted my protagonist to also be a Ranger. And the reason why this plays so centrally in the book is that there's a part of the fifth stanza of the Ranger Creed which reads, never will I let a fallen comrade fall into the hands of the enemy. And again, to you or I, that might just be words on a page, but I saw that played out in real time in Afghanistan when that same mission I was talking about, there were a number of SEALs who were unaccounted for. And until they were found, the war in Afghanistan basically stopped as the United States brought every asset they could to bear to finding those men. And that's something I think that's rather unique to the U.S. in that we still go out of our way to repatriate remains of fallen service members from World War II or Korea or Vietnam, because that's kind of the deal that your country makes with you if you go into harm's way on her behalf. And that is, I can't guarantee that you will come home alive, but I will guarantee that you will come home, that we will make every effort to bring you home, whether you're still alive or whether it's your remains. And that's a very unique thing to the American military. And then in particular, the folks who are a part of the special operations community take that one step further. And there's a fantastic example of that during the operation that went horribly wrong, that was the subject of the book Black Hawk Down, in that there were a couple of helicopters that had been shot down, and the folks inside had died by the time that the rescuers got there. But the rescuers, even though they were under fire and even though they knew the people in the helicopter were already dead, would not leave until they had every single person accounted for and every person taken out of that helicopter, because dead or alive, that is the oath that they swore to each other, that never will I leave a fallen comrade to fall into the hands of the enemy. And that was just so powerful to me, and so powerful to me to see that through my coworkers' eyes. I knew that my protagonist, Matt Drake, had to be a former Ranger as well. And that kind of that theme and that portion of the Ranger Creed plays very heavily throughout Without Sanction.
Let's talk a little bit about the details of, arms, weapons, equipment,
sure.
Aircraft, vehicles, the things that, lend the book a lot of credibility. So mm-hmm. To what extent are these items,
yep.
Things you actually use and had your hands on, and to what extent you had to learn about them in order to put them in the book?
Sure. So I'm not, and I'm like you said, I've had the fortune to have a very interesting background, but I'm not, nor have I ever been a member of the special operations community. And so while there are things in there that I knew from being an FBI agent, or obviously there are scenes in there that I drew from my experience being a pilot, there was a lot in there in the book that I had to learn about. And so I wrote, there's a scene in there that is a high altitude, high opening insertion. And I know I've never been to airborne school. I knew nothing about that. And so I wrote kind of a bare bones version of that scene and gave it to a friend of mine who was from the special operations community and said, hey, will you read through this and help me get this right? And so after several iterations going back and forth with him, I was able to do that. And again, I did that with a number of areas in the book where I had subject matter experts read it and give me feedback on it. And 99% of the time, I would change whatever they recommended to lend that veracity that readers of this genre expect. But there's that 1% of the time where you need to tell a compelling story above everything else. Like you said in the beginning, this isn't a nonfiction book. And so there were times where my friends said, this part really wouldn't happen like this. And I said, yep, I got it, but it makes a better story, so I'm keeping it in. And hopefully I put a big enough disclaimer in the acknowledgement sections of Without Sanction that anything in true in here is due, or anything that rings true is due to the tremendous cadre of subject matter experts that helped. And anything I messed up is because I messed it up. And so don't blame them for that. But it was a really fun process, and it was really fun to kind of pick my friends' brains and go through that. So, yeah, absolutely, that was a huge part of it.
Let me also talk about you were deployed in Afghanistan. The action of this is around ISIS and set in Syria, a certain part of Syria.
Yep.
And it's the area where we have these deconflict efforts that go on between the U.S. And Russia in particular. So tell me a little bit about that setting.
Yeah, so there's a couple different reasons why I had it set in Syria. And one of it is you know, the obvious, the relevance. When I was writing this book during earlier drafts, ISIS played a lot heavier in it because it was, you know, ISIS still controlled a good chunk of Syria and Iraq. And it was a huge thing that was on the tip of most Americans' tongues. But the other part that's kind of fascinating about Syria is that you have all these different groups, both proxies and major powers, that are all in this little cauldron who are fighting each other, fighting different proxies, fighting everybody else. And so you can imagine, in fact, you know, there were real time things where Russian and US forces would have to deconflict movements or operations because they're targeting each other's proxies or targeting, you know, the fighters that one or the other are protecting. And so it's this cauldron of shifting alliances where, you know, maps mean nothing because one neighborhood might be under Hezbollah control and the next neighborhood under might be, you know, a U.S.-backed proxy. And so there's this whole notion of shifting alliances and you know, the lines on the map being as varying as or as non-permanent as lines that you would draw in the sand. And so that was part of it. And the other part of it, too, is I wanted, going back to what drove me to write it and those questions I was asking, is I really wanted my character, my protagonist, Matt Drake, to have to go through hell again, if you will, to get to the point where he felt like he had atoned for what had gone wrong. And I can't think of too many places on earth that more typify hell than the horrible conflict that has gone on, the civil war and everything else that has gone on in Syria for as long as it has. And so that was kind of that conglomeration of things led me to place the majority of the book in Syria.
Well, I want to ask you about one more thing about Syria. This is a particular part of Syria. I mean, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I have the feeling that where you've got Matt Drake in what amounts to eastern Syria, I think, whereas if he was in Damascus, he might be sitting in a sidewalk cafe enjoying a coffee.
Yeah, that's right. And I purposely put him in what's kind of like the frontier, if you will, of Syria, because I wanted a place where all of those – where you still had little sections that were still controlled by ISIS, where, you know, Russian-based proxies might bump up against U.S.-based proxies, where the Turks may or may not be. And I was really looking for that cauldron, like I said. And it's kind of reflected in the book as he goes through and who he bumps into and what he does. Because, number one, I think it's fascinating from a clinical perspective to see, you know, a country destabilized into this mishmash of shifting alliances and conflicts. And then number two, because it ends up being very, very interesting to place the story there. And I think it was one of the things I found fascinating as I was researching it was that when ISIS took over large swaths of territory, both in Iraq and in Syria, there were a lot of folks for whom their standard of living actually improved under ISIS. And it's much the same that Hezbollah was able to do in Lebanon, because you have this horrific group, this death cult, if you will, but they come and impose order, and all of a sudden, you know, the electricity starts running and trash is collected on time. And the basic services that humans crave now are starting to be implemented, albeit by this you know, like I said, this horrible death cult of a group. But that to me was a very strange thing that I wanted to explore a little bit either, that it's that you can have freedom perhaps in a completely chaotic environment when you can't even get electricity or water or basic services, or surrender that freedom and have tyranny, but you now have some of the basic things you need in order to keep yourself and your family alive.
You want to talk any about the role of the president in this story?
Yeah, it's so I wanted to. So Without Sanction has two major plots, if you will, and one that centers around Matt Drake, and the other that centers around what's happening at the White House at the same time as Matt is undergoing this operation. And I think it's interesting that the more technology has advanced, so you can literally sit in the Situation Room of the White House and watch a raid half a world away unfolding in real time. And so you can watch that, but you're still, at the end of the day, you're still sitting in a climate controlled, you know, Situation Room, not in the blood and dirt and dust that the operator or the pilot is currently experiencing. And so while that person who is conducting the raid or the operation on your behalf is very much focused at the task at hand, the folks who are watching are politicians at heart and have, you know, they're not worried about getting shot or the visceral ramifications of the operation as much as they potentially are worried about the political ones. And so I thought, you know, I kind of wanted to show that in the president, in the there are two or three characters on the political side of the subplot, and one is the president, and one is the president's senior advisor, and the president wants to do the right thing, and the senior advisor thinks that the right thing is for the president to remain to win re-election. And so there's kind of a clash in the book between what the operator needs on the ground, what has to happen because of that creed that never will I leave a fallen comrade to fall into the hands of the enemy, from the person with their boots and dust and blood, and the politician sitting half a world away in an air-conditioned room whose more consideration is what are the voters going to do when they head to the polls in 24 or 48 hours. So, yeah.
There's some kind of standard questions when I do these interviews I ask authors. So what do you read?
I read pretty widely across a number of genres, but obviously I read extensively in the genre that I write, the military, political thriller, espionage thriller. And there I grew up, you know, what first drew me to this genre and actually made me want to be a writer was reading Tom Clancy. And I remember being, you know, a teenager when I read Hunt for the Red October and some of the other books. And I have, as a side note, I have the great fortune of working with one of Tom Clancy's editors, a guy named Tom Colgan. And so to think that, you know, the books that I grew up with and the author that I idolized as a child, I now get to work with his editor still blows me away. But I read, you know, a ton of Tom Clancy. And in the early years, the folks who were writing kind of those epic military thrillers, people like Harold Coyle, who wrote Team Yankee, or Larry Bond, who wrote Red Phoenix. And then around the 90s and early 2000s, there are new cadre of writers like Vince Flynn and Brad Thor and Daniel Silva, who took the genre in a slightly different direction and added to it. And now, you know, that I read people, still read them, and I read people like Kyle Mills and Brad Taylor and Mark Graney. And just there are so many amazing folks who are working in this genre right now. Nelson DeMille is a huge, huge influence of mine. He writes a very witty first-person protagonist in his John Corey series. The first of those books is called Plum Island, and that resonated with me so much. I remember reading the first one of Nelson's books with that protagonist and turning to my wife and saying, man, I would read about this guy going to the grocery store because he's so funny. and it's so well done. And that's one of the reasons I write my protagonist, Matt Drake, in a first-person point of view as well. So I read a ton in that genre. I also read a lot. I was a big fantasy buff growing up and still read people like Brandon Sanderson and Robert Jordan and Greg Keyes and all of Terry Goodkind, all of those folks as well. And so I read pretty extensively. I try to focus more on my genre. I think the person in my genre who is doing it is at the absolute top of his game right now is Daniel Silva and his great Gabriel Allen or Alan, however you say it, his protagonist. And in fact, his oftentimes when I'm editing, I will read a Daniel Silva book because he's what he does. He's one of those rare people who is, he writes almost at a literary quality and he's an incredible wordsmith, but he's also got the plot and the characterization to keep you turning pages as well. And so I think he is probably the master of the genre I want to write in.
Well, you're writing a thriller that involves military action or quasi-military or paramilitary action. Wouldn't you call Daniel Silva's book more like spy novels?
Yeah, he definitely took the Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy and did more of the hard espionage, if that's a term. Now he does, one of the distinctions is that his protagonist, Gabriel Allen, is a former Mossad assassin. And so there are certainly elements of his book that have kind of the paramilitary action in it, but it is much more minimized and much more focused on the cloak and dagger aspects than say what Brad Taylor writes or Mark Graney or really Kyle Mills and Vince Flynn and Brad Thor now as well. And so I think you could look at that and say maybe that's another division within the subgenres. Is he definitely, in my opinion, Daniel Silva definitely harkens back to more of the cloak and dagger British espionage kind of things, but he is a master regardless.
Well, yeah, no, I wouldn't take that away from him in any sense. Now you spent some time in the writing program, getting an MFA at Seton Hill University. To what extent do you think that the writing program actually helped you?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'll preface that saying the majority of the folks that I referenced or that I know don't have degrees in writing. And in fact, my own degree, undergraduate, was in electrical engineering, which is not known to generate fantastic writers either. And what I'll say though is all of those folks, if you look, Brad Taylor or Mark Graney or any of those people who don't have traditional writing undergraduates, there are technical aspects from a writing standpoint that you have to understand when you're going to write a novel or a short story or something like that. And so you have to learn those either through feedback or taking some introductory writing classes. There's some way that you need to learn the conventions of what is in a novel, what is in a three-act story, how do you actually do that? And there are a number of different ways to do it. I was fortunate enough that I had the GI Bill and was able to attend that writing program free. And it was also another thing that makes Seton Hill unique is that it is a unabashedly genre focused MFA program. And so when you come in, they ask you, do you write horror, science fiction, thrillers, mysteries? And they pair you with an advisor who also writes in that genre. And so their goal is to help you turn into a writer who writes commercial fiction as opposed to some of the literary programs. And it was very beneficial. But what I will say is if you're someone who has a limited amount of money, I think the most bang for my buck that completely changed the trajectory of my career is a writing conference known as Thriller Fest that meets in New York every summer. And it was founded by people like Lee Child and Steve Barry and a number of massively successful writers in that genre. And the interesting thing about a good writing writing conferences is that you can meet folks who are actually successful in the profession that you're trying to pursue. So it's one thing to sit in a class and learn about theoretically what makes you a good writer or how to change. It's a completely different thing when you can sit across the table from Brad Taylor and listen to him talk about his publishing journey, or you meet editors, or that's where I met my editor, my agent, many of the people that I call friends now. Meg Gardner is another Austinite who writes incredible books, and she teaches workshops every time at Thriller Fest. And so to me, that is the money best spent, because you're connecting with people in the community who have actually done what you're trying to do and are there to kind of give a hand up to other people who are trying to make their way in that same profession.
So, okay, so you've been very generous with your time. Let me this is something I always ask guides who are in your line of work. So what's your day look like? How much, what's the writing day?
Yeah, so I still have a full-time day job. And so what I tend to do, because I am a writer and also an electrical engineer, is that I've got when I'm working on a project, I know when I need to get it done, and I break that word count into weeks, and I have a nice little spreadsheet that tells me if I'm on track, off track, how many words I need to write that week, and then I go through and log it every week. And so what I tend to do is I have one session in the morning, so I get up kind of early before everybody goes to school and whatnot, and write for a good hour or so, sometimes a little more if I can get it. Then I'll do a second session at night, and after dinner and kids are doing homework and such, to try and either make up some ground or do get some more words or try and get ahead. Because again, like everyone else, the day job has certain expectations with it as well. And then Saturdays and Sundays, I spend a lot of time writing or rewriting and then thinking as well. That's when I'm kind of going over. My wife is a very tolerant person for a number of reasons, but not the least of which being I tend to, as I'm plotting, I'll write out all the scenes on note cards and scatter them across every available surface in our house. And so Saturday and Sunday is when I spend time both writing and sorting out those note cards and ripping them up and probably writing the same one on a new note card and shuffling it around. So it's a full-time job, I guess, from the standpoint of I don't have any other hobbies or there isn't anything else I do, but it's also something that's, you know, it's one of the most rewarding vocations in the world when you're writing something and you know people are enjoying it and you know my wife is my first reader, and when she reads the draft when it's ready for the first reader and stuff, and to see her laugh at things and enjoying it, I mean, there's really no better feeling in the world than that, than writing something, knowing that something that you've written is resonating with your audience.
Don Bentley is the author. The book is Without Sanction, a Matt Drake thriller. It's got a whole bunch of blurbs from famous people like Lee Child and who think highly of it. And I think you probably will, too. I've enjoyed it very much, Don, and I've enjoyed talking to you. And I appreciate you taking the time today.
Likewise, John. Thanks for having me.
All right. We'll end the recording right now.